Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, happy to introduce our show to you today, April 29th, 2006. Today, we wrap up Earth Day Month with information on the politics of food. And we bring you information on current events with U.S. and Iran relations. Here's what we have coming up for you. Our news will include Ann Miller of New Hampshire Peace Action calling in live to us from the New York City anti-war protest. Then, in our first hour, we focus on Iran. We hear voices from the Middle East interviewing Joe Cirincione, Director of Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, followed by EcoShock Radio with four reasons why the U.S. will attack Iran. Our extreme news segment will deal with the real story behind the threatened attack on Iran. Our second hour will feature an interview from Red Eye Co-op Radio on organic versus local food buying, and we hear from Labor News about genetically modified crops and food for children left behind. Job Parrish will tell us about the history and future of May Day, and we'll end with Between the Lines out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
Here are some news stories from the past week or so that you may have missed. Free detainees not allowed home, from Reuters, but printed in Australia's Herald Sun. Nearly 30% of the Guantanamo detainees have been cleared to leave the prison but remain jailed because the U.S. government has been unable to arrange for their return to their home countries, the Pentagon said. The Pentagon refused to identify these 141 men despite having released its first comprehensive list of detainees held at the prison for foreign terrorism suspects at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Of these 141 detainees, among the 490 still at Guantanamo, various military reviews have cleared 22 to be freed in their home countries and the remaining 119 for transfer to the control of their home governments. Kurt Goring, a senior Amnesty International USA official, said, "It's just an outrageous situation where people have gone through the system that has been established, such as it is, and the U.S. government itself has found there's no reason for them to be held any longer, and yet they continue to be held. It makes a mockery of any kind of system of justice," Mr. Goring added. Officials cited U.S. policy not to expel, return, or extradite individuals to other countries where it is more likely than not they will be tortured or persecuted. Rights activists decry the indefinite detention of Guantanamo detainees since the jail opened in January 2002 and accuse the United States of torture. The Pentagon said the detainees hail from 40 countries in the West Bank, with the largest number from Saudi Arabia, followed by Afghanistan and Yemen. And next, test blast in Nevada, a nuclear rehearsal. Pentagon apparently looks for an optimal size of a bunker buster. From the Salt Lake Tribune. A powerful blast scheduled at the Nevada test site in June is designed to help war planners figure out the smallest nuclear weapon able to destroy underground targets, and it has caused concern that it signals a renewed push towards tactical nuclear weapons. The detonation, called Divine Strike, is intended to, quote, "develop a planning tool to improve the warfighter's confidence in selecting the smallest proper nuclear yield necessary to destroy underground facilities while minimizing collateral damage," according to Defense Department budget documents. While it will not be a nuclear explosion, no nuclear or radioactive material will be used, the Divine Strike blast will be 50 times larger than the military's largest conventional weapon, the Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb, or MOAB, nicknamed the Mother of All Bombs. It will still be many times less powerful than the smallest weapon in the U.S. nuclear stockpile. The June 2nd test will entail piling 700 tons of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil atop a buried limestone tunnel on the Nevada test site, then detonating it to measure the damage that would be done to the chambers. The Defense Department's 2001 Nuclear Posture Review lays out a new, broader role envisioned for nuclear weapons than the part played during the Cold War. And from the BBC News, Iran, quote, "fails to heed nuclear call." Mr. Ahmadinejad said Iranians should not be denied their rights. Iran has ignored a UN Security Council demand to suspend all nuclear fuel enrichment, the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog has concluded. Mohamed El-Baradei told the UN Security Council that Tehran had done little to answer questions over its intentions. President Mohammad Ahmadinejad said earlier Iran did not, quote, give a damn about the UN resolution over its research. The recent IAEA report said Iran had offered to clear up any outstanding questions if the matter remained within the framework of the IAEA rather than the Security Council. The Iranian moves are in defiance of a UN Security Council warning a month ago. Washington is trying to rally support from the Security Council for tougher action, including sanctions, a course so far rejected by Russia and China. Iran says it has the right to peaceful nuclear technology and denies Western claims that it is seeking weapons. Tehran vowed to hit U.S. targets worldwide if subjected to a U.S. military attack. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei also said this week Iran was ready to share its nuclear technology with other nations. And from the Portland Press-Herald, hundreds decry war at forum in Portland. Passionate opposition to the war in Iraq characterized a town hall-style meeting Friday that was organized by more than 40 peace groups, church committees, and other organizations. About 400 people attended the event at the University of Southern Maine in Portland. The forum was billed as one where opinions both for and against the war could be voiced, but speaker after speaker denounced the war as illegal and immoral. They spoke of the American and Iraqi dead, criticized the Bush administration as deceptive, called for the president's impeachment, decried the money that could be used instead for health care, and spoke of how the occupation is the main source of violence in Iraq. Many speakers expressed frustration at Maine's congressional delegation, and Governor John Baldacci. Organizers said they were invited but could not attend. Each politician's name was on a card placed on a table in front of an empty chair on stage. Organizers planned to send each a videotape of the event. Jonathan Carter, a former Green Independent Party candidate for governor and director of the Forest Ecology Network, used part of his 3 minutes to call for a slate of new elected officials. He said, "One way we can stop this war is elect people who will stop it." I'm joined by Ann Miller, live at the demonstrations in New York City. Welcome, Ann.
Oh, thank you for having me, Steve.
What's going on there? What's the feel in the air?
Well, sure. The march began actually later than expected. It was slated to step off at noon and actually didn't get going till almost quarter of one, and it's because there's so many people here. It's been so exciting. A lot of energy, a lot of good spirits, a lot of people out here marching in the streets to protest the war and occupation of Iraq.
Uh-huh. Any idea about how many people? I mean, to some sort of sense?
I heard numbers of 500,000, but again, I don't know what that's going to look like when it comes down, what the official numbers are going to be or what the official organizer numbers are going to be. We should know that in a couple of days.
And how would you... go ahead.
No, please.
How would you characterize the crowd?
Really excitingly young, both reflected in our bus. We had a number of high school students and college students, and then also down here at the march itself. So a lot of great energy, a lot of chanting, a lot of very creative signage.
Indeed. Do you have any favorites, one or two that stuck in your mind?
There's actually a great one. It's a big caricature of Bush, and there's cloth that's being pulled out of his mouth, and on it is written fear, lies, hate, and it just rotates around, and it's actually the art of somebody from the Merrimack region, which is very, very cool. He came on down. He wasn't on our bus, but a New Hampshire creative.
Wow. What was pulled out of Bush's mouth?
Oh, just these words, fear, hate, lies, and then it just kept rotating around and around and around.
Mm-hmm.
So, an action figure.
I see. Did there end up being any speakers this time? I know there was a bit of a controversy moving towards this event.
Yeah, it was really interesting. No, there are no speakers and no music per se. There were tables. People were tabling. I think there were something like 19 different groups, everything from nuclear abolition to global warming to women and choice to the environment and legislative strategy looking forward to 2006, all of those things. And what I find so interesting is that on March 19th, as organizers were planning the statewide event that were going to be centered in Concord for the March and the third anniversary, we did the same thing. And there was the same concern that there weren't any speakers, there wasn't a focus. So I think there are lessons that both New Hampshire and the national organizers can learn.
Mm-hmm. I thought that event went great too, though. So.
Oh, great. Yeah, thank you.
So is there anything else you'd like to add before we head off? We look forward to speaking with you again soon. But anything else you'd like to say about this march?
I'm real excited with the number of people. We weren't expecting this big a turnout again, and that's why it kicked off 40 minutes late, because the Nine for Peace and Justice is a great organization. They do a great job at marches and rallies, but I think just the numbers here were totally unexpected. And so keep our fingers crossed and hope that it's reported accordingly, as it is due.
Sounds good. Well, and we look forward to hearing you speak. I know you just came back from Israel recently, Israel-Palestine. And there's speaking appearances you have in Durham and Dover, and I'm sure other places coming up in the next week or so. So we look forward to seeing you there.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, please come on out. And it was interesting, too, just real briefly, there's a lot of signs and things about freeing Palestine as well as freeing Iraq. So I thought that was really auspicious. And no war in Iran, obviously. It wasn't just limited to Iraq, which was nice and important to see.
Indeed, yes. Today's show was focused largely about the possibility of nuking Iran, which we're definitely very concerned about. All right, and I guess we have to get going, but good talking with you, and we'll catch you later.
Great. Thank you so much, Steve.
Take care.
Bye.
This is Making Waves. For the remainder of this hour, we focus on U.S. and Iran relations. Now for Voices from the Middle East, with an interview of Joe Cerencioni.
This is KBOO's The Voice of the Middle East. With me tonight is Mr. Joseph Cerencioni, and I would like to welcome you to the show. Joe Cerencioni is the Director of Nonproliferation at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome, Joe.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
You wrote an article in Foreign Policy where you said, I used to think that the Bush administration wasn't seriously considering a military strike on Iran because it would only accelerate Iran's nuclear program, but what we're seeing and hearing on Iran today seems awfully familiar. That may be because some U.S. officials have already decided they want to hit Iran hard. Could you tell us what signals did you see that made you come to this conclusion?
Well, first it was friends coming to me, telling me that senior officials, including the vice president, had already decided they wanted to overthrow the Iranian regime, that this was the plan. And I argued with them. I said, this is crazy. What are you talking about? And I gave all the arguments that any of us would give about why this couldn't possibly be true. And they said, Joe, you don't understand. They've decided. They're going. They're willing to accept the risk of chaos in the Middle East in order to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, and they're convinced that Iran is trying to. I listened to them, and when three of them told me the same story from different perspectives, people who knew the White House, people who knew the Pentagon, I started to take it seriously. Then I started seeing stories in the press about, once again, you know, leaked memos from the British be 2 weekends ago now, that British officials had concluded that a strike on Iran was practically inevitable, as reported in the British Telegraph, or consultations that the Israelis were having with the U.S. I thought I'd take this more seriously, but it was the actions of the administration officials themselves that finally convinced me. When I saw them roll out this sort of coordinated campaign, Vice President Cheney made a major speech focused on Iran, and followed by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice calling Iran the main state sponsor of terrorism. Then President Bush blaming Iran for attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq. even though there was no evidence to actually support this, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Peter Pace, had to say that there wasn't any evidence to support this claim. And then the strategic doctrine of the United States is reissued, once again talking about preemptive attacks and signaling out Iran as the most serious challenge to U.S. national security interests. That's what finally pushed me over the edge. That's where I realized they're doing it again.
There are, I guess, some people, or some of the, even the scholars in the field, they speculate that this whole discussion that is now kind of like a public all over the world, and it's even getting more attention in Europe than here, is just a psychological war affairs. And one of the senior former national security staff that I read his email on another bulletin board, he even suggests that maybe this, I mean, he says that he trusts, say, Hirsch, and he doesn't think that there's any reason for him to fabricate this information, or you in that matter. But he thinks that there might be some wrong information given out, or possibly feeding them, because if this is the strategy for U.S. administration to create this psychological warfare, then it makes sense for them to create these misinformation and disinformation.
Right.
What do you think to that?
Here's why I think that's not true. I completely understand that. And part of it is that most sensible people think it's completely insane to even contemplate a war on Iran. So we can't believe that our senior officials would be this stupid, that they really would think about this. And so Cy Hirsch writes his article, which I've read now several times, and I find to be substantially accurate. And if people haven't seen it, they should go read this article. He's got tremendous sources, and his people are telling him in much more detail what I had heard separately. And then on Sunday, last Sunday, the Washington Post does a front-page story basically confirming Cy Hirsch's article, from different sources, but saying, yes, this planning is going on. Yes, these discussions are happening, but they interpret it differently. Cy Hirsch says this is an indication the administration is serious, that at least some officials have decided they want to go to war. The Washington Post says, well, no, this is part of a diplomatic campaign to convince the Iranians that they have to stop their program. The problem with that latter analysis, and several, maybe many in Washington now support that version of the story, is that the U.S. shows no intention of actually wanting to negotiate with Iran. So when the President or the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, says, we're pursuing a diplomatic approach, our policy is focused on diplomacy, well, that's not actually true. We don't have a diplomatic approach to Iran. We are not talking to Iran. We don't recognize Iran. We're not in direct negotiations with Iran. We've rejected repeated offers by the Iranians to talk. What they're talking about is that we're trying to do a coercive effort at the UN Security Council to increase the pressure on Iran to have them basically give up their program without conditions. Now, I believe Iran should stop its program, but no country in history has ever been coerced into giving up a nuclear weapons program or nuclear weapons. But lots of countries have been convinced to do so through negotiations, through exchange of compromises. The U.S. shows no sign that this is the kind of deal that they want to make with Iran. So that's what convinces me that this is not a psychological game. This is not a stick that we're rattling in order to gain diplomatic concessions. Until we have U.S. officials actually saying they're willing to sit down and negotiate with Iran, I have to believe that all this saber rattling is really about drawing out sabers.
You mentioned that U.S. did not accept an offer for negotiation and talks, and I'm reading from Flint Leverett, the secret cabal.
That's a very important revelation. Flint, and it was then confirmed by Larry Wilkerson,
exactly,
former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell.
That in 2003, the Iranian negotiating offer transmitted to the State Department in early May 2003 by the Swiss ambassador in Tehran acknowledged that Iran would have to address U.S. concerns about its nuclear program, although it made no specific concession in advance of the talks. According to Flynn Lever, they were ready to discuss everything. And I guess this is a pattern because U.S. did not even discuss the nuclear issues with North Korea, nor did they do with Libya. It was Brits who talked with Libya and kind of came up with that agreement. What is behind this refusal to get engaged in this case?
Right. It really gets to the heart of the issue. What is the administration's goal here? Is it to end the nuclear program, or is it to end the regime? What's the real point here? And what I fear is that some administration officials, perhaps including the president, Cy Hirsch says it does, believe that what they have to do is end the rule of the theocracy in Iran. Now, you know, we all want to end that rule. This is a despicable regime. These people do terrible things. They have, you know, killed dissidents in their bedrooms in Paris. They have put thousands of innocent people in jail. These are not nice people. The question is, how do you change that, and who changes that? Do the Iranian people do it, or do we do it? And I believe that many in the administration wrote about their desire to overthrow the Iranian regime and the Iraqi regime before they came into office, and they still have those plans. That's their goal. They see this as part of the transformation of the entire geopolitical structure of the Middle East. Iraq was supposed to be the beginning of this transformation. As my colleague Josh Moravchik from the American Enterprise Institute said, it was going to let loose a democratic tsunami that would sweep through the Middle East. And just 3 years ago, when the Iraq War seemed to have been a success, the slogan in Washington that you heard from these neoconservatives was that men go to Baghdad, real men go to Tehran, that we were going to move on to Damascus, to Tehran, to Riyadh. We were going to run the deck here, run the table. And I believe that some, despite the catastrophe of Iraq, despite the failure of this war policy, believe that what we have to do now is stay on the offensive and move on to Tehran. That's my worry. I hope I'm wrong. But I've seen a lot of signs that senior officials and their advisors are interested in taking this war to Tehran, and I haven't seen a single senior administration official who's been advancing or arguing for negotiations with the Iranians, U.S.-Iranian negotiations. Our allies are urging us to do this, but we haven't done it. That's right. What worries me. It takes about 1,500 centrifuges operating for a year to make enough material for one nuclear bomb. They have 164 that have been operating for a couple of days. So they've got a long way to go. Can they do it? Probably. When? The best estimates are 5 to 10 years from now. If everything goes well, 5. If they experience problems, and they almost certainly will, 10 years. So we have time to let diplomacy work. We don't. There isn't really a crisis. There isn't a nuclear bomb crisis, even though our officials talk this way. We're not in danger of Iran getting a bomb this month, this year, even this decade. What it is the diplomatic crisis.
I was talking to Joseph Cerencioni. He's the director of nonproliferation at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
That was an interview from Voices from the Middle East. And now we move to EcoShock Radio with a report on 4 reasons why the U.S. will attack Iran. You're listening to Making Waves, and we are focusing this hour on relations between the U.S. and Iran.
In case of emergency, nuke Iran. You know, like break glass, only murder people by the millions.
Down in the polls, just nuke Iran. This is news from Radio EcoShock.
According to Seymour Hersh, in April's New Yorker magazine, a faction in the Bush administration has plans to use nuclear bombs against targets in Iran. The pretext is to stop the Iranians from developing a nuclear bomb. the precedent breaks 60 years of nuclear peace, to drop the first atomic weapon in anger since the incineration of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 60 years of marches, lobbying, and struggle by people all over the world opposed to nuclear weapons might come undone soon. The president who brought you secret detention camps, torture, spying, and unprovoked war against a country has plans for a new atomic age of terror. In a world of conspiracy and violence, we'll cover four major theories of why America will nuke Iran. First, the Jewish people are terrified that Iran will wipe out Israel with nuclear missiles, a horrible second Holocaust. Then, there are stories that Vice President Cheney has plans to nuke Iran following any 9/11 type incident in America, whether Iran did it or not. Third, we'll look at the hidden plot line of oil, how Iran is threatening America's passion to control Middle East oil and the American dollar itself. Finally, the neocons from the Council on Foreign Relations think America shouldn't stop with a nuclear attack on Iranian atomic plants and labs. These intellectuals and their banking friends see a great opportunity. Thinking they now have nuclear supremacy, America should just nuke every atomic weapon site in the world, including the Russians and the Chinese. Total victory! Total domination! All published in the March-April issue of the magazine, Foreign Affairs. We'll get to that. Let's begin with Seymour Hersh, speaking to ABC Radio in Australia.
If you really want to guarantee that you're going to get rid of the major underground facility in Iran that's believed to be tied to nuclear activity, a place called Natanz, which is 75 feet underground, if you want to be sure, the only way to be sure is with a tactical nuke. This is one of the options given in an option paper by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the White House. Nobody was advocating it. They were just saying 100% guarantee. Where it becomes interesting, the Joint Chiefs, in one of its subsequent papers, wanted to withdraw that option because, of course, it's madness. A nuclear weapon in the Middle East to an Arab Muslim country, my God. Then the White House wouldn't withdraw it. And that's the issue, that the White House, some people there still wanted to have this option.
Mr. Hersh also revealed the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, not to mention his Pulitzer Prize revelations of the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War. You can find more in Slate Magazine, an article by Fred Kaplan, April 10th, titled, Are We Really Going to Nuke Iran? Fred Kaplan wonders if this is just another version of Richard Nixon's Let Them Think I'm a Madman strategy in Vietnam. We saw how successful that was. Iran isn't buying it, and they have a president who also qualifies as a madman. Madmen, my friends, are threatening the Earth. This nuclear bravado, perhaps purposely leaked by the United States, is meant to hammer on Europe to make them consider sanctions seriously. We saw how well sanctions worked in Iraq. Meanwhile, alleged high-level sources within the U.S. military say there is active resistance to the idea, and some generals will resign if the government moves toward the nuclear option. In the event an order is given to drop a nuclear weapon for the first time since Hiroshima, we may all end up hoping a military coup will displace Bush and his neocon gang. Our time's already so desperate that the world prays the military men will revolt, as they did against Hitler in 1944. Of course, the nuclear story may be a cover to make us all feel better when the Bush boys attack Iran with conventional weapons. We'll all be relieved they didn't start a nuclear war yet. According to Hersh, the Navy has been flying simulated nuclear bombing missions for more than a year, launched from aircraft carriers in the Arabian Sea. They are practicing delivery of weapons of mass destruction.
Plot number one.
Drop the bomb to stop the bomb.
Let's start with Israel. In 2002, Bush declared Iran to be part of the Axis of Evil, a phrase coined by the Canadian speechwriter David Frum. News about a nuclear attack on Iran has been brewing since the start of 2005. In March 30, 2005, Scott Ritter, the former weapons inspector in Iraq, wrote Sleepwalking to Disaster in Iran. It was published in the Arab news agency Al Jazeera. Contacted by someone close to the Bush administration, Ritter claims he was warned of a plan to attack Iran in June 2005 because the Israelis were worried about Iran's nuclear enrichment program. Well, now, that enrichment program has produced its first batch of weapons-grade uranium. The heat is on. Since the Iranian president said Israel should be wiped off the map, while questioning the Holocaust and pushing Jewish hatred, the Israeli and Jewish people everywhere have plenty of cause for sleepless nights. The Iranians have already demonstrated a missile capable of delivering a nuclear payload to Israel or even to southern Europe. Israel's Minister of Defense of the day, Shaul Mofaz, said, quote, "Under no circumstances would Israel be able to tolerate nuclear weapons in Iranian possession," end quote. Israel itself is thought to have at least 200 nuclear weapons. Contemplating the possibility that a few nuclear missiles could render the Holy Land into atomic dust, being such a small country, Israel loudly announced they had refitted conventional submarines with underwater nuclear missile launch capabilities. Obviously, if Israel was struck by weapons of mass destruction, the Jewish state would respond from under the sea, wiping out large Muslim cities and holy places in the Middle East. We have a precedent for Israeli first strike against Muslim atomic power. In the mid-1980s, the Israeli Air Force used modified American planes to bomb a nuclear power facility in Iraq, built by France, just days before the reactor was due to start up. The Bush administration may be in a forced race with Israel to destroy Iranian nuclear facilities before the Israelis do it. According to Scott Ritter, Israel had a plan to destroy Iranian nuclear facilities since 2003. These relationships are so complex, they may be moving beyond anyone's control. When nuclear fear sets policy, policy goes mad. Ritter said, "The American media today is sleepwalking toward an American war with Iran."
We do have a saying in America, if you're in a hole, stop digging. Not sure I should have said that.
Plot number two.
Our second nukem plot is not based on Israel, but arises from American internal problems. The Project for a New American Century, or PNAC, already described the need for a new Pearl Harbor to instigate a stronger state. Now, the president and his gun-toting buddy are so low in the polls, they may think only of another 9/11-type attack to bring back public support. We know that the Bush insider gang plotted an attack on Iraq even before they came into office. 9/11 allowed them to do it, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. If there's another attack, says intelligence analyst Philip Giraldi, Vice President Cheney has nuclear battle plans ready to attack Iran, whether they were guilty or not. They are waiting for an excuse to seize total control of Middle East oil and to repay the Iranians for seizing the American embassy in 1979. We hear more about the Cheney nuke mousetrap from right-wing sources, people you would expect to be Bush supporters. For example, Justin Logan of the Cato Institute at www.justinlogan.com reprints key paragraphs from Philip Giraldi's article in American Conservative magazine, which is not available online. In print, Giraldi says, quote, "The Pentagon, acting under instructions from Vice President Dick Cheney's office, has tasked the United States Strategic Command, STRATCOM, with drawing up a contingency plan to be employed in response to another 9/11-type terrorist attack on the United States. The plan includes a large-scale air assault on Iran, employing both conventional and tactical nuclear weapons. Within Iran, there are more than 450 major strategic targets, including numerous suspected nuclear weapons program development sites. Many of the targets are hardened or are deep underground and could not be taken out by conventional weapons, hence the nuclear option. As in the case of Iraq, the response is not conditional on Iran actually being involved in the act of terrorism directed against the United States." Several senior Air Force officers involved in the planning are reportedly appalled at the implications of what they are doing, that Iran is being set up for an unprovoked nuclear attack, but no one is prepared to damage his career by posing any objections. End quote.
The Cheney doctrine from last summer is there's going to be a new 9/11. It's going to be blamed on Iran automatically, right, and it will be the basis of an atomic attack on Iran, and that's the perspective under which these people have been working. And it has a wag the dog component, of course. It gets the crumbling of the Bush administration off the front page.
Some of these so-called hardened targets are right in the capital of the country, Tehran. Shall we nuke the capital of Iran? This would please the Osama bin Laden crowd. As Sunnis, they loathe the Iranian Shiites almost as much as Americans. If Sunni radicals could stage another 9/11 incident, the American Goliath will nuke their enemies for them.
Yeah, well, you just leave a bunch of dead people behind and all their relatives angry.
Let's hear from Giraldi himself, speaking with Scott Horton, an anti-war activist at anti-war.com, speaking on the quite conservative Republican Broadcasting Network on July 26, 2005.
And I'm talking with Philip Giraldi. He's a former CIA counterterrorism official, now writes deep background for the American Conservative magazine. And, sir, you were saying before the break.
Well, basically, some officers in the Air Force are talking about a contingency plan that is being drawn up at the instructions of the White House, more specifically the Office of the Vice President. And the plan essentially is for a nuclear response against Iran if there is another major terrorist incident in the United States, something along the lines of 9/11. The scary thing about this, the Dr. Strangelove aspect of it, is that the thinking that's going down here is basically that you would use the opportunity of a terrorist attack to take out Iran as basically a threat in that region. I don't have to explain to you that the policy in that region has been insane right from 4 years ago.
Dick Cheney's got a gun. Dick Cheney's got a gun. The safety's come undone. He's squinting in the Texas sun. What did our leader do? Who did put a bullet through? They say when Cheney goes to Texas, you'll find him.
This Cheney has a plan chatter became intense last summer in 2005. Now it's back. Why?
Plot number 3.
We move to a nuclear motive that American media don't seem to cover. It's all about the control of oil and money. Deep in their own hardened mental bunkers, executives of oil companies, chemical makers, and automakers want to own Middle East oil supplies forever, whatever it takes.
It's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil.
We'll hear a theory that the real motive to attack Iran is not the protection of Israel, but a desperate attempt to stop an Iranian oil trading scheme that could jeopardize the American dollar and reroute American oil to China instead. Our speaker here is Webster Tarpley, a so-called 9/11 conspiracy theorist and author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror. We have to be careful with Webster Tarpley, as he was for many years the public spokesman for the Lyndon LaRouche Group. LaRouche was hostile to environmentalism. He named Greenpeace as his enemy, hired his people out to the nuclear industry as spies, and admired German Nazi scientists just a little too much. LaRouche ended up being jailed by George Bush Sr. for defrauding old ladies of their fortunes. Tarpley seems to have reinvented himself, although he is part of a group which includes talk show host Alex Jones, who still interpret the world by the LaRouchean idea, a conspiracy of global control by elites that include European royalty, the Rockefellers, and, of course, the Jewish Rothschilds. Nevertheless, speaking about the American dollar and Iran, Tarpley seems to make sense. Let's give him a listen.
And that brings us to the big threat, which is this Iranian oil bourse, which was supposed to open on March 20th, which has been delayed by various kinds of, I think, technical difficulties, political difficulties that the U.S. and the British have thrown up. Remember that this would be the first open market or exchange or bourse since 1945, really, where you could buy oil for a currency other than the dollar. It would be the euro. Since the end of the Second World War, the rule has been if you want oil, you must have dollars, meaning that whoever controls the dollars, i.e. the U.S. Federal Reserve and Treasury and the London Euro dollar market, if they have the dollars, they control the oil, and it doesn't matter so much who nominally or seems to own the oil. It's really in the pocket of the U.S. and the British, and this, of course, has been another way to create completely artificial demand for dollars by saying, if you want to buy oil from Iran or Saudi Arabia or Indonesia, you've got to have dollars. That's the only way. That means that there's a tremendous demand for dollars that otherwise wouldn't be there.
So, if Iran were allowed to create a new way to sell oil in euros or just straight trade for consumer goods from someone like, China, the financial stability of America might be endangered by a further decay or even a run on the dollar. Better bomb them first. The Chinese recently sealed a deal with Iran to buy $100 billion worth of oil. Will intense competition for oil start an undeclared war with the United States and China held in proxy countries like Iran, just as America and the Soviet Union fought in Angola and Vietnam?
Plot number four.
Finally, we come to an open and published plot where America uses thousands of nuclear weapons to neutralize all others and gain total control of the world. This may sound like something from the old cartoon Pinky and the Brain, but it comes from the periodical Foreign Affairs, the mouthpiece of the elite intellectuals, politicians, and bankers on the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR. Webster Tarpley, speaking at the beginning of April 2006.
But even more immediately, this question of the nuclear first strike, the article, and yes. I urge people to read this because this is absolutely chilling. Foreign Affairs, the issue is March, April 06. It's called The Rise of U.S. Nuclear Primacy by Keir A. Lieber, L-I-E-B-E-R, and Daryl G. Press, P-R-E-S-S. One of them, let's see, Lieber is from Notre Dame, Daryl G. Press, University of Pennsylvania. And they're telling you that the Russian nuclear deterrent is now decaying. It's collapsing, they say. It has been radically cut in all three of its legs.
Standing back just a little, it is amazing how the United States is going from productivity to rank decay and the hubris of empire in just a generation. It's like watching the Romans fall in a couple of decades. So predictable, but with nuclear weapons ripe with terminally ugly possibilities. For these American intellectual thugs writing in Foreign Affairs, so distant from the seared bodies in Hiroshima, Russia's actions to disarm are seen as decay, and China's hesitancy to spend billions on the lunacy of horrible nuclear weapons, and rather to educate and feed their people, is seen as weakness, as an invitation to bomb the hell out of this historically peaceful people. In a paper presented at a Berlin conference on the Middle East in March, Colonel Sam Gardner, a military analyst who taught at the National War College before retiring from the Air Force in 1987, described the necessary targets to neutralize nuclear technology in Iran. There were 400 targets, and that didn't include the chemical plants and other goodies the U.S. and Israel would like to remove. Hirsch says that military men, as high as the Joint Chiefs of Staff, are now advising the president against using nuclear weapons in any form. They're opposed by the Defense Science Board, a contraption whose members are all appointed by the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld himself. This board thinks science can deliver a tidy nuclear weapon with limited radiation to use anywhere. Just a few little nuclear bombs, no big worry. The Bush administration is advised by men appointed by the Bush administration. They listen only to themselves. Many of these men who approve of helpful nuclear weapons have been appointed to key posts in the administration. As Hirsch tells us, they include, quote, Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, Stephen Cambone, the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, and Robert Joseph, the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. All these were members of the Defense Science Board. When nuclear bombing to get your way becomes state policy, there are strange twists. America itself taught Iran how to build the bomb. The crazy scheme, approved by President Bill Clinton, delivered the blueprints for a nuclear bomb to Iranian physicists. It was called Operation Merlin. The joke was, there was a hidden error in the plans that would kill the bomb makers. But Iran was not in a vacuum. They consulted the Russians, who corrected the error for them. Now the plans were complete. Thank you, America! This is a central fact of all nuclear madness. Those who develop new weapons of horror always leak and lead the way for many others to follow. The weapons come home. They blow a hole in our lives, and our psyches, and our cities. The radiation is shared by everyone on the globe, and by countless innocent generations to come. This crop of madmen take us to the brink of species suicide. When the first nuclear bomb is dropped, no matter how small and tidy, and a mushroom cloud appears anywhere in the Middle East, well, it's time to meet your new friends, the Hezbollah, the army of God, who managed to defeat Israel and move them out of Lebanon. These are the people who will be soon arriving on America's door with whatever weapons they may find, whether nuclear or biological. The genie is out of the box. Anybody can make a nuke for any reason. No city can feel safe. Here is the father of physics, of our knowledge of the universe and the bomb, Albert Einstein.
the physicists who participated in forging the most formidable and dangerous weapon of all time cannot desist from warning, and warning again. We cannot and should not slacken in our efforts to make the nations of the world, and especially their governments, aware of the unspeakable disaster they are certain to provoke, unless they change their attitude towards each other and towards the task of shaping the future.
The physicists who participate in watching the most formidable and dangerous weapon of all times cannot resist from warning and warning again. We cannot and should not slacken in our efforts to make the nations of the world, and especially their governments, aware of the unspeakable disaster they are certain to provoke, unless they change their attitudes toward each other and toward the task of shaping the future. So said Albert Einstein. Nuclear technology is out there for anyone to find. Crude plans were on the internet for years. Children learn Einsteinian secrets at their parents' knees. University physics classes create new potential bomb makers every day in many parts of the world. The black market is filled with people selling plans and materials. The only and last remaining dike against awful incineration is this. No one has been crazy enough to use one. No one, it seems, until now. This wake-up call to those who love life and peace comes from Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. Tune in to free, full-time, all-environment radio.
Britain's Foreign Secretary Jack Straw has today commented on the reports of using nuclear weapons to attack Iran. He called such a plan completely nuts.
Extreme news. News too true to be true. Iran irony. Bush and Cheney announce Iran nuclear attack, an experiment in irony. From the Extreme News Syndicate, Washington, D.C. In a press conference on Thursday, the President and Vice President of the United States confirmed what obscure blogger Andrea Feinstein, a New Hampshire homeschooled 10-year-old, reported on her website on Monday. Andrea's website suggested that the planned nuclear strike on Iran in response to its nuclear program is just a ploy by the Bush administration to test the American people's grasp of irony and raise flagging reading comprehension SAT scores. The president's brief prepared remarks got right to the point.
Young Miss Feinstein clearly has an extraordinary grasp of what public school children, and in fact the American people, clearly do not. Let me quote Webster's dictionary. Irony, noun, an outcome of events contrary to what was, or might have been, expected. Nuke in Iran so they don't develop nuclear technology? I mean, how stupid do you people think I am?
The president added,
I mean, didn't we all learn that in, like, the seventh grade?
At press time, Andrea was unavailable for comment due to her paper route responsibilities and a rerun marathon of Who's the Boss? The vice president expressed concern that America's children were being left behind when it comes to reading comprehension grade point averages.
We want to ensure that America's children are paying attention in their English classes,
Dick Cheney said.
Standardized testing in school is not enough to ensure proper education. The president and I have shown decisive leadership by bringing this test to the American population at large.
He described the results of this test as rather disappointing. Bush blames Clinton. President Bush wasted no time in explaining the source of this shortcoming and prescribing decisive solutions.
Clearly,
Years of Clinton's misfocus on math and science scores has resulted in a generation too bad in English to know irony when it hits them in the pants,
President Bush said. Their new plan of attack involves increased spending on irony education added to the No Child Left Behind Act. Bush said,
And anyone who doesn't get the joke past seventh grade will be sent to basic irony training in Iraq.
In a telephone interview from Camp Cicero, a U.S. military base which covers much of northern, central, and southern Iraq, National Guardsman Tim Newstead stated in confusion,
They promised us great medical benefits and forced us to pay for our own meals in the hospital when we were wounded. We were asked to give up our civil rights to occupy a hostile country in the name of freedom. I don't understand why the local insurgents and foreign fighters don't let the coalition forces bring peace and free market prosperity to this troubled country. At least by being here, I can punish Saddam Hussein for what he did to us on 9/11.
Clearly, Guardsman Newstead will be remaining in Iraq for quite some time. That was Extreme News on Making Waves with Amy Antonucci and Steve Diamond. And now Dave Lippman brings us a little history in the form of the Iraq Opportunity Song. Don't forget to come and see Dave Lippman. He's playing Tuesday, May 2nd at 7 p.m. at South Church on State Street in Portsmouth. For more info on that, email info@seacoastpeacerespondence.org or call 603-749-9159.
You and I must make a pact. We must bring Iraq back.
Where there is oil, I'll be there.
Oh, you and I travel to the beat of a big oil drum. Can't you see by my car that runs 15 gallons to the mile? The Lord above made man to rob his neighbor. No matter where, with neighbors he is cursed. The Lord above made man to rob his neighbor. But with a little bit of luck, with a little bit of luck, with a little luck, I'll get there first. All together, with a little bit, with a little bit, with a little bit of room and luck. The gentle sheiks were made for us to curry, to drill our oil and keep it flowing without cease. The gentle sheiks were made for us to curry, but with a little bit of luck, with a little bit of luck, we can have it all and call it peace. I ain't no wimp, I ain't no gimp, no need no symphony. I played this one alone with Tony Blair on timpani. I ain't no fall guy, I'm a tall guy, and I'm gonna do what Cheney tells me to.
Don't forget to come and see Dave Lippman. He's playing Tuesday, May 2nd at 7 p.m. at South Church on State Street in Portsmouth. For more info on that, email info@seacoastpeacerespondence.org or call 603-749-9159.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.